Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and we're delighted to have you with us today. Today we're going to talk about 9 healthy months, being a healthy mom and having a healthy baby, and also the impact of the healthcare reform and what that might mean for women, what they might stand to gain, what they might stand to lose in the proposals that are being batted around for healthcare reform. And so in a minute, I'll introduce our guest this week, Dr. Charles Hux. First of all, I wanted to let you know that this program is brought to you every week by the VHL Family Alliance, and VHL is a hereditary cancer syndrome. So let me play you a little message about VHL, and then we'll be back to speak with Dr. Hux.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Welcome back, and we hope that you will support the work of the VHL Family Alliance. I wanted to introduce now Dr. Charles Hux. Hello, Dr. Hux. It's nice to have you with us.
It's very good to be here.
Thank you. So you're out in Ohio, right?
No, I'm in New Jersey. I came from Ohio about 35 years ago.
Uh-huh.
That's where I was born and raised, but I'm working in central New Jersey near Asbury Park, and did most of my training in Philadelphia at the universities Thomas Jefferson and University of Penn.
So you're what's known as a high-risk obstetrician, right?
Correct. That's correct.
And so anybody who has special risk factors would be well advised to seek some advice from someone like yourself. At what point does someone seek out a high-risk obstetrician?
Well, if a patient has a medical problem prior to getting pregnant or is affected with some sort of continuing or recent problem that they did not have, you know, a short while before, it's always recommended to seek out a consultation with a high-risk specialist before getting pregnant, because you need to know if there are any special things that need to be done, any special tests that would need to be done. And if a patient is seeing a physician for some medical problem, she definitely should seek a consultation with that doctor, letting them know that she either has just become pregnant or is planning on becoming pregnant, to discuss anything that would need to be done during the pregnancy or prior to it.
Right. I mean, because of the people in the VHL community are at risk for having tumors of the brain, spinal cord, kidney, places like that.
Yeah.
We always say to them, as you say, to not only speak with someone in obstetrics, but also to speak with their neurosurgeon and their urologist to make sure that there are no special risk factors going on that might mean that it might be unwise to carry a baby, at least until some of those things get repaired.
Absolutely. People with VHL and with other diseases that can affect them, in other words, they can have waxing and waning throughout their life where it can be bad for a period of time and then better. It's always good to see the doctor who's you're under their care to make sure you're in a good period in your life where there's not something that's acting up as far as whatever disease you may have, and that it's under control. That's always the best way to prepare for having a child.
Right, and there's going to be a 9 month period. That's the best part of a year there, where we can't use radiation, for example, because it would not be good for the baby. So we want to make sure that if there is something that might occur for the mother during that period, that the whole team is aware of what might happen, has a sort of backup plan just in case, for example, if someone has a brain tumor that acts up, what might we do about it? And because we want the mother to come through this and be healthy and take care of that good baby.
Absolutely. We have treated many cancers with both radiation and chemotherapy during the pregnancy. You have to work very closely with the oncologist, with in this case with your group, would be neurosurgical or neurology group, and with the obstetrical doctors to plan what would be the best management. But we have used all types of therapy during the course of the pregnancy with very little to no effect on the fetus.
That's great to know. And so as much as possible, we want to reduce the number of surprises, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
absolutely.
All those doctors know each other's phone numbers and can collaborate at the drop of a hat.
Yes.
Now, I read in some of the material that you had out that if you're planning to have a baby, you ought to schedule a visit with your dentist.
Absolutely.
Tell us about that.
Well, dental infection, the infection in the gums and having dental decay, is one of the top three reasons a woman will deliver a baby early. Because,
really?
Yes, because bacteria and dental decay get into the bloodstream and can very quickly cross over into the placenta and get the placenta and the fluid around the baby infected. And unfortunately, antibiotics do not take care of it.
Mm.
You cannot treat an infected mouth with antibiotics and hope that an infection that transmitted itself across to the baby or into the placenta can also be treated, because it cannot be. You can't cure an infection that would cross over to the fetal compartment. You're just going to end up delivering the pregnancy early. We recently had a woman who has had, unfortunately, many, many, many years of dental issues, dental problems with gum disease, and never went really to the proper types of dentists to have this completely cured. She's had 5 miscarriages all at about the same time, around 15 to 22 weeks, and lost each child, unfortunately, and all because of dental decay.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
It's not at all uncommon. It's a rather common reason for a woman to start having premature contractions and ultimately end up delivering prematurely because of untreated dental problems. So one of my recommendations of many we have is that a woman should just get a basic dental cleaning of the teeth and an examination to make sure there's nothing going on as far as infection or decay, which could transmit itself through her bloodstream from the mouth down to the baby. And just to make sure that that's not going to be a possibility, just to have this done before she gets pregnant.
Right. So when we know we're beginning to think about having a baby, that's good. But what happens if you have not taken good care of your mouth and you get pregnant? So because half the pregnancies are unplanned, right?
That's correct. And the thing about it is that it's perfectly fine to take care of it the moment you realize that there's something going on in your mouth. It either hurts to chew, or there's something you didn't take care of a few months ago before you got pregnant. Now you're 2 months pregnant, 3 months pregnant, and you really have a hurting gum somewhere, one of the teeth. You need to see the dentist right away, because x-rays are perfectly fine.
Dental x-rays.
If you could take the whole mouth and multiple different views, and there actually is no fallout from radiation to the fetus. When they just put the lead cape over the woman, there's actually a zero fallout. You could take as many as 100 dental x-rays without even getting any radiation to the baby.
Great.
So it's perfectly safe. The other things that are safe are local anesthetic, to be used to treat dental decay, to treat a cavity, or to treat something they would need to do drilling. Antibiotics are relatively safe. They just need to be cleared with the obstetrician or the high-risk obstetrician. And using local anesthetic, as I said, is fine also.
Mm-hmm.
Pain medication afterwards, if necessary, is also fine.
Right.
So taking care of it during the pregnancy is good. What's not good is to have some sort of dental problem and then not do anything about it and just hope for the best. You really need to do something about it because you don't want to deliver a baby 8 weeks early that's going to be in the nursery for a long time and may have a short-term or a permanent disability from that early birth.
So early birth is a major risk factor for the baby, and not just about the developmental issues that
right.
happen. I mean, we hear about lung development and spending time in an incubator
Mental.
And that kind of thing. But
Mental.
You're talking about long-term issues, things
long-term,
like
yes.
learning disabilities or
yes.
physical disabilities. Tell us about that.
Learning disabilities, mental retardation, cardiac abnormalities. Abnormalities that are continuous with the lung, including long-term asthma and other types of lung problems from being born early. These are all things that can occur. They don't necessarily occur. You can certainly have a baby 2 or 3 months early and have a great outcome. It's just that the risk of there being short and long-term problems, certainly learning disabilities and that type of thing, are very high on the list of risk to the baby.
So the way Mama Nature designed this is the baby's supposed to stay 9 months in the very best incubator there is, which is in the mother's uterus, right?
Correct. Correct. And the good thing is that the nurseries these days have gotten a lot better at taking care of early born babies. So we are in a better situation than we were when I started about 30 years ago. But it is certainly better to be in the womb unless there's some major problem going on where it would be safer for the baby to be outside of the womb.
Right, right. So what are the other risk factors for preterms? Because I was reading some statistics about the infant mortality in this country. And
mm-hmm.
infant mortality here is really quite high.
Very high.
The last time we had a measure of it, which was 2005, I think, we were the 29th in the world in terms of baby health.
We're now 37th.
We're 37th. At the time, we were tied with Poland 29th. And Slovakia.
Yes.
Where are we now?
We're much lower on the list.
So we're tied with some third world countries.
Yes, yes. And we would say, why is that possible?
Why is that possible? Tell us.
So, well, one reason is that, of course, The changes in the health care plan, no matter whose health care plan is passed, is going to provide health care for people who don't have any health care. And for pregnant women, who we're talking about today, a lot of pregnant women will not seek out any prenatal care if they do not have some sort of medical insurance, whether it be Medicaid, Medicare, or private insurance. They'll not go for prenatal visits. And in not going for prenatal visits, the risk to the baby is 4 to 5 times higher for complications than if you went for prenatal care. So it really, really drives up the risk right through the roof for babies that otherwise would have a great chance of doing really well. So we're hoping that the changes in whatever they do in the healthcare plan, it really doesn't matter which plan it is going to provide care for all women so that they can seek out and have insurance in some way for prenatal visits and prenatal care.
So just getting prenatal care for all pregnant women would go a long way to improving that statistic.
It will allow us to detect a safe environment in the womb for the baby. And sometimes there is problems that cause there to be problems with having a safe environment. High blood pressure, diabetes, other types of problems that the mother can have can also potentially cause damage to the baby remaining in the womb. So in treating those problems, we can improve the healthiness of remaining inside the mother and have a better outcome. So that's certainly very important, and it's something that is going to happen no matter what healthcare changes occur in the political spectrum in Washington. The other thing is that 8% of pregnant women today in the United States still smoke. And smoking is by far the worst problem that we have, because there are 350,000 women of the 4.5 million that deliver that smoke during their pregnancy. And the 3,000 to 4,000 chemicals in each cigarette go across into the fetal compartment, increasing the risk of premature birth, increasing the risk of the baby being small and having complications of a newborn being very small and tiny, increases the risk of mental retardation and learning disabilities, heart defects, and other kinds of problems, increases the risk of stillbirth or sudden infant death syndrome also.
That's a pretty awful list.
It's the worst list. It's actually far worse than being on heroin.
Really?
Oh, much worse than being on heroin. Heroin simply means that the baby has to be withdrawn from the morphine drug, and so does the mother eventually. But being on heroin isn't anywhere near as bad as smoking cigarettes.
For heaven's sake.
We have women who smoke a pack a day who call and ask, is it safe to take a Tylenol? Because they don't want the Tylenol to get to the baby and potentially hurt it. And I said, you know, you smoke a pack a day. Oh, yeah, sure, I smoke. No big deal. I said, well, it's a real big deal. And they said, no, my mother smoked when I was in her, and I'm okay, so I should be able to smoke too. That's the most common comment that I get. I get that every time I talk about smoking. And I am for a zero tolerance to any cigarettes being smoked in pregnancy. It's actually, you're actually harming the baby for real. You actually are causing harm to the baby by taking, it's no different than taking any other drug. It's just that the drugs and the preservatives and things that are in cigarettes are by far worse than taking any illicit street drugs, except cocaine. Cocaine destroys the placenta, causes it to come off the wall, and can very frequently be associated with just a stillborn. The baby just dies in the womb from cocaine.
I mean, but there are states that would put a pregnant woman in jail for using heroin because you're putting your baby at risk.
Correct.
And yet we seem to take smoking in stride.
Correct.
When it's
correct.
So much more potentially damaging.
It's much worse. And I think, to be honest, law is going to change related to smoking over the course of the next few decades. I don't think it's going to happen immediately, but over the course of the next 10, 20, 30 years, I think there's going to be a lot more restrictions related to smoking at all. And especially when you're carrying a newborn, another life inside of you. So I think we're going to try to get women, and I'm doing everything possible in Washington and every place I can to get the population who becomes pregnant to understand the potential damage that they can do to the baby. And in fact, really all women want a healthy child. You ask them one thing they want, and they'll say, I just want the baby to be healthy and being, you know, not have any problems.
Right.
And yet they smoke, and they'll put that off on the side. They can't accept that that would be a problem. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we have to work on. Anyone who is in the media or who is in the medical fields or whatever, to explain that there is a real serious, potentially serious problem that you can, you're exposing your baby to cigarette smoke directly. The baby gets 36 hours of the chemicals in cigarettes for one cigarette. We don't, as adults, I mean, we do, but we really move the chemicals out quickly through our lungs and in our own body. But in the baby, everything's transmitted through the bloodstream across and will stay there for a day and a half for just one cigarette. So the baby, if a mother smokes during the pregnancy and she says, well, I only smoke 10 cigarettes, that baby is being exposed 24/7 the entire 9 months to the 4,000 chemicals that are in the cigarettes. So I think it probably increases the risk of cancer for the child during its life, increases the risk we know for asthma and lung disease, and it decreases the IQ. It increases the risk of brain damage and certain types of developmental delay. So, you know, if there's just anything that I can do, it's every day when we have the patients in my office, I will talk to anyone who is a smoker who comes in and is pregnant. So, the other real big thing is diet, obesity, and diabetes in the pregnant population in the United States. The pregnant population has doubled the number of women who are overweight over the past 15 years.
Really?
Doubled.
Yeah.
It's 33 to 36% overall that percent of pregnant women are morbidly obese with a BMI greater than 30 or in general a weight greater than about 220 pounds. So more than a third of women. And it varies on different ethnic groups. Some ethnic groups are lower and some are higher. But if you take the average, it's a little more than one-third of all pregnant women are morbidly obese. That increases their risk of an early birth, of being delivered by cesarean section, of having, of course, diabetes, which is so common today in pregnant women. And we have diabetes in teenagers, which is quadrupled in its percentage over the past decade.
Right, and it's not just the number of people who are diabetic when they get pregnant, but there's
right,
a
right.
gestational diabetes. There's a kind of diabetes that can occur during your pregnancy.
That's right.
What makes that happen?
Well, that happens because the blood pregnancy hormone called HCG causes insulin not to work as well. So the insulin that you produce each day in your pancreas simply doesn't get the blood sugar down the way it would if you weren't pregnant. It sort of mutes or decreases the ability of the insulin you have in your body to work as effectively as it does when you're not pregnant.
So let's say it brings it down to 80% of what it would normally be, but in most people that drop is
okay.
Not enough to create a real problem.
Correct.
But in people who are already sort of borderline,
yes.
it drops you below the level.
Yeah.
Is that...
That's pretty much it. And people who have it in their family, it runs in the family, or who are morbidly obese and are carrying higher levels of sugar in their body on a day-to-day basis, it's just too much for the body to produce enough insulin to actually deal with that the sugar level and the pregnancy. So they show that they are gestationally diabetic. Now, we can get them under control with diet and with insulin or with oral medication. But the key is that if you remain greater than 20% over your normal body weight 5 years after you've delivered the baby, you have a 50-50 chance of having diabetes. So that you have a really good chance of having diabetes if you don't get down to a good body weight for your height, and 5 years goes by and you're still heavy, you're likely to have a 50-50 chance of really at that point having diabetes. You're likely to have a 50-50 chance of having it 10 years from the delivery, even if you get your body weight down.
So it's also a signal that
mm-hmm.
You're at risk for
yes.
getting diabetes on a regular basis.
Absolutely is. It is.
So I'm sure that good people like yourself have studied these statistics and looked at things like Japan and Sweden seem to have the lowest infant mortality. What
they
is
do.
It that they're doing that we're not doing?
They get a little exercise. They walk more. Much more than we do. They just get in general daily exercise. You know, if American women walked 90 minutes a week, which is 30 minutes three times a week, they would decrease the risk of complications by probably 20 to 30%. We're a sedentary society these days in the United States, and the population in general eats way more in volume of food than they should.
Mm-hmm.
The people in these other countries, it isn't what they eat, because they a lot of countries that have the 90% of the population within the normal range of body weight have food that is actually very high in fat and very complex meals that they eat. The difference is, there's a big difference, and that is that they don't eat much of it. They'll have a tablespoon, which is their portion,
mm-hmm.
instead of having a plate full of the food. So we just had dinner with a couple from Europe who, I'm not sure which fast food, we eat at not a fast food place, but a restaurant that is everywhere around the country, one of the nice dinner restaurants, and they couldn't understand, they couldn't believe how much food was brought to them for one dinner.
Right.
Salad, the appetizer, the entree, the side dishes, the drinks, and the dessert. They said, this is like four times what we would normally eat in amount of food at any given meal.
Right, and it's not just the number of courses, it's how much of it is on the plate.
Yes.
There'll be twice or
yeah.
four times as much
four
as
times
you served in Japan or Europe.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so obviously that quadruples the number of calories. You can easily leave one of those restaurants and having eaten 4,000 to 7,000 calories for the dinner and not really feel like you ate any more than you normally would eat for a dinner if, you know, you don't make your own food at home. And a lot of people say, well, you can't eat a really good meal unless you cook it yourself, and a lot of people can't afford to do that. And I don't believe. I think you can eat out and eat a very healthy dinner. You can eat out at many different restaurants, have salad, soups, broiled or grilled meats, and just simply eat what would be a normal portion and take the remainder home with you if you want. But I think the key for this country is that the American people have to, women and men, have to take some responsibility to take care of themselves a little better. The one thing they want to do is to be around, in the work I do, the parents want to be around for their child or their children.
Right.
They want to be with them and see them growing up and actually see grandchildren. But when I see moms and dads weighing 200 to 500 pounds, which I see every single day of the week, it's really very, very disheartening, because ultimately they're going to leave their children orphaned by the time the children are in their 20s or 30s.
Hmm.
And it's so. And the other thing is, I see a lot of women in the United States who now are having children between 40 and 55 years of age. And this is becoming more and more and more common. And that in and of itself causes problems, because there are more medical problems in people at that age. But, again, getting back to what I was originally saying, people have to take some responsibility for their own health care and their own living a good life. And you can live a very enjoyable life and enjoy all kinds of your favorite foods and everything and still not have to be overweight by 100 to 300 pounds.
Right.
And I think that's the key. The key is that Americans now take back some of the responsibility that they have kind of forgotten about in taking care of themselves to live a longer life. Everyone out there who's in healthcare and looking at this situation is saying, well, the people in the baby boomers might be living to 70s to 85 years of age, but the younger people who are in their 25 to 45 group, that more of them are overweight, have diabetes, have all kinds of other problems, and are going to have the more later in life medical illnesses at a much younger age than in the past, and may not actually live as long as the baby boomer generation or the ones people who are now over 50.
Right.
So, you know, we don't want that to happen, and it is up to Americans themselves to try to get a little more exercise and not drive everywhere and walk around the block a few times every other night and get out a little bit. And children also. Children need to not be on the computer and on the cell phone 10 hours a day. They need to get out and walk around a little bit.
Yeah, I've noticed that kids are not in the sandlot anymore. They're not out playing baseball.
No,
they're not out biking and,
absolutely,
you know, playing with the dog. They're in front of the television and playing with
the computer. And, you know, the way we grew up, that was very different. We didn't have those things.
Right.
Those things are amazing. They are, you know, they have done a lot positive for society, but in the same time, in the same situation, they have decreased our ability to enjoy life, where we would walk around and play with one another out in the sandbox and stuff. They're playing baseball. Instead, you want to be online and talk to your friends on the message board and on your computer, on your cell phone. And the funniest thing I see is young kids, preteens, teenagers, and the children, they're talking to their friends standing next to them on the telephone, messaging each other on the phone, right next to one another instead of just talking.
Right.
So, you know, again, I say it's fine that the government is trying to make healthcare better, but the problem is that in the United States, we care for illnesses that are already there. We care for people who are sick in the hospital and already have the illness. And the thing that I'm pushing for is to spend more money on preventative care, getting people in line to really want to be preventing these illnesses from occurring in the first place, certainly as young as they're occurring. So in the pregnancy, which is what I deal with, I try every day, and with the book that I wrote, 9 Healthy Months, I emphasize in every chapter about the prevention of illness and preventative care and trying to get as healthy as possible pregnancy so that the baby will come out with the best chance the baby can have for 70, 80, 90 healthy years of life, and the mother and the father will try to start living a healthier lifestyle if that's necessary so that they can be with them.
Right, right. And it starts with teenagers, for example, who don't want to admit that they're pregnant. They're terrified to go talk to their parents about it. And so they like pretend they're not. They just wear sweatshirts or something.
Absolutely.
And they're not going to the doctor. They're not
getting their
vitamins.
Oh, they're not.
They're being subjected to smoke even if they're not smoking themselves. And those are the kids that we need to get to the doctor during that pregnancy to make sure that she's going to be fine and that her baby is going to be healthy, because it's an investment in that child's whole entire life.
You're absolutely right. That's exactly what I tell these people. You're absolutely right. I see a lot of teens in my practice who are overweight, who did not tell anyone they were pregnant. They come with only 2 to 3 months left of the pregnancy, and they're putting the baby at risk, and they're trying to deny that it even has happened. I was talking to someone else in the media the other day about this issue, and we said, you know, we have to get together the people in the teaching, the healthcare workers that work in schools, along with doctors and people who work in the healthcare industry, to try to make an open discussion for these teenagers that get pregnant, so they feel comfortable talking with people both at the school and in the medical area, so they don't feel like they're going to run to their parents and just tell everything about them, because they're really emancipated women who are now pregnant, who should have the ability to have things kept between themselves and the medical field.
Right, and we need a safe harbor for them.
Absolutely.
You say, there has to be a safe place for them to talk about the fact that they are pregnant. This is the reality. I don't care if you approve or disapprove. It's not about that. It's about now we have a new soul that's about to enter the world, or we're going to have that baby be healthy or not.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
And then there are the people who, as you say, are at the other end of it, who are waiting till 35 plus to have their first baby.
Right.
And this presents, when I had a baby at 28, they called this an elderly pregnancy,
mm-hmm.
quote unquote, when I was 28 years old. And now people are seven and more years older than that having first baby.
Yes,
what kinds of special concerns are there for those people?
Well, they certainly have an increased risk of high blood pressure, heart disease, diabetes, and the complications of simply being over 35, but it's more... not really 35. It's really women who are more in their early 40s and beyond. I just delivered a set of twins to a woman 57.
Wow.
Who did not have any children. She wanted to get pregnant. She had finished her career. And it was a rather selfish move that she get pregnant at 57. Her husband had just had a heart attack and was not in good physical condition. And she went ahead and had a set of twins and basically said that there were some things she didn't know, like she could get arthritis, get being pregnant, and she said, oh, if I had known that, I wouldn't have gotten pregnant. And it was just, none of it made any sense to me. Not that she didn't get pregnant at a younger age, but she chose to do this where these children will most certainly become orphans in high school or earlier.
Right. I mean, if we just do the math, if she's
57, yeah. Yeah.
by the time those children are 18, she's
mm-hmm.
going to be 75.
Correct.
And to have teenagers when you're 75, number one, you've got a pretty short fuse for teenagers.
You do. You do.
And so it's kind of an unfair setup for yourself and for your teen.
Absolutely, it is. And I don't think it's fair. It really isn't. And the infertility doctors that get them pregnant have made some rules related to that, or some things they are, you know, are trying to live by not getting women in vitro after the age of, say, 48 or something of that nature. I just think in their late 50s, it's just too much for everybody. It's not fair to the children.
Right. And, you know, maybe it was a donated egg or something, but by
yes,
the time you're 57, that your eggs are getting
pretty old,
too. You
don't even have them yet. You don't have eggs anymore then, and so it has to be a donated egg also.
And to sustain that pregnancy, you've probably got to take hormones throughout the pregnancy, right?
You do, yes.
Because your body doesn't have enough of the natural hormones to sustain the pregnancy.
Exactly. One of the big chapters we have in the book is the myths of pregnancy, and the two big myths are that you're always eating for two, and that's why you can gain so much weight. That's a myth. You don't have to eat for two. We always recommend women who are of normal weight gain around 20, 25 pounds, but women who are heavier don't need to gain any weight at all in the pregnancy. They just need to stay on a good Weight Watcher type healthy diet and maybe gain a few pounds at most, and the babies will be 6 to 9 pounds and perfectly healthy. The other myth is that the cord around the neck is dangerous, and that's just a myth. It's not at all something that's dangerous because it happens about 50% of the time in all babies. The cord wraps around the shoulder, the neck, the body, and doesn't cause any problems. It's the way the cord is actually designed, like a barbershop sign. It's twisted so that even if you tie it in knots, the blood still goes through the umbilical cord to the baby and doesn't pose any harm.
So you mean if you see it around the neck on the ultrasound or something, you don't need to panic?
You do not, no. It's around the neck half the time of half
right.
the babies. So, but
it's
a myth.
It's during the delivery, if it's not
yes.
properly handled during the delivery.
You may need
a
C-section, sure.
Right,
that's
okay.
Possible.
But other than that,
nothing to worry about.
Yeah. What other myths are there?
Oh, so many. Well, we have a lot of women who don't like to go to a dentist with a problem because they don't want to have an X-ray of their mouth. And I said earlier on when we were talking, there's really no risk to that at all.
Okay.
And then myths about eating. A lot of women are told they shouldn't eat any fish during the pregnancy. That's not at all true. Fish that are large, like tuna and shark, may have a little more mercury or other types of heavy metals in them, where we do not recommend you eat one of those types of fish more than once a week, but
mm-hmm.
you may still eat it. And as far as other fish, the smaller fish like tilapia and flounder, you can eat them every day of the week while you're pregnant. There's no risk to that at all.
Right.
And As far as other types of myths, women who are reaching up into the cupboard to get something are told you can strangle the baby with the cord that way, and that's, of course, also a myth. But we have a rather long chapter in the book about that.
Yeah.
And the book is also going into Spanish within a couple of months, so we're going to have it available in English and Spanish.
That'll be wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, one of the other things that I noticed, you said that you do, that you have also studied genetics, so you're a geneticist as well. And I know traditionally most genetics departments are attached to maternity or pediatrics.
Right.
And so tell us a little bit about how routine is genetic testing during pregnancy?
Genetic testing has become a lot more routine because the risks of doing an amniocentesis have dropped tremendously. The risk of doing it to losing the baby used to be quoted as 1 in 200. And our risk now is around 1 in 1,500 to 2,000 as a risk, which really is about equal to not having it. So it's pretty much down to zero as a risk. And that gives you the yes or no whether a baby has, for instance, Down syndrome or 400 other chromosome abnormalities which are possible. So women are now offered amniocentesis no matter what their age. If they want to know if a baby has a genetic chromosome abnormality, the only way to find that out is not through screening tests, which are blood tests, or measuring the back of the neck, or looking for signs on ultrasound. Those are all just screening tests that give you a possibility the baby may have some sort of problem like that. The only thing that's diagnostic that'll say it does or does not have it is looking at the DNA of the baby. And the way we do that is by doing the amniocentesis.
Right. And that's done about what point in the pregnancy?
About 15 to 20 weeks. Between 15 and 20 weeks, so that's between 3.5 and 5 months of pregnancy. There is an earlier procedure that I do called chorionic villus sampling, which is done at 10 to 11 weeks. And that gives us the very same information just earlier.
Now, it used to be that there were special risks about that chorionic villus sampling, CVS test.
Right.
Is that still true, or is that
no? Actually,
well?
It's not. No, the risks that were quoted a few years ago were that the babies could have danger in losing their hands and legs with that procedure, and that came from some doctors who tried to do the procedure at 8 to 9 weeks, not 11 weeks, which is when we do it.
Uh-huh.
And at 8 to 9 weeks, the arms and legs are still under formation and development.
Mm-hmm.
And they found a 1 in 100 risk that those babies they did at 8 to 9 weeks did lose fingers or an arm or a leg or a foot in having had the procedure. But in the group that we have always been with, which is the group of doctors that just do it at 11 weeks, there's essentially a zero risk, 1 in 9 to 10,000 risk that would happen, which is the same risk in the general population. So there's no risk to doing the procedure at 11 weeks.
Great. I'd like just to remind the audience that if you do have a question, you can either put it in the chat or you can dial our telephone number and ask it live during this live recording. The telephone number to dial is 347-237-4358. And just press 1 to raise your hand, and we'll turn on your mic so you can ask your question on the air. So in terms of genetics, if someone knows that there is a genetic risk factor in their family, what's the first thing to do?
Well, the first thing to do is to seek out a genetic counselor who can go over that information and tell them if there's anything that can be done to detect this in the baby or if the baby is at risk. And if that's the case, then I could speak with the couple also as a geneticist and go over what that particular birth defect is and if there is any risk to the baby that the woman is carrying. If so, we can do the detection through amniocentesis or CVS.
We often coach people on how to find out what risk factors there are in their families, and one observation that people have made is that they had never even known about some of the the babies who died, you know, the babies who died in infancy or young or something like that. People don't tend to talk about them. But when you start to talk about that with your aunts and uncles, and then sometimes those dead babies come out of the woodwork and you begin to hear about them. And those are important stories to know about
because they are
risk factors that
they are and sometimes
are preventable.
Yes. And each couple should talk with family members that are still alive about any of those possible factors for, risk earlier in the other generations that may have been affected with birth defects.
We have a question. Area code 862. You want to ask your question?
Yes, hi. excuse me. I wanted to ask about one of my friends. See, she had a few pregnancies. She miscarried her first two pregnancies. And then into her third pregnancy, about 5 or 6 months later, she found herself diabetic, and she was concerned about passing that on to the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the baby was delivered, the baby was not diabetic, and the mother remained on medication for a while, and then it went away. So I wonder more about what the cause of this gestational diabetes is. Yeah, people who are not diabetic until they're pregnant, and then all of a sudden they develop it. Why is that?
Well, gestational diabetes can occur where it doesn't show up in the family at all. It's just a function of being pregnant. The pregnancy hormone actually decreases the body's ability to respond to insulin that we make every day. And so some people don't make as much insulin as other people do, and so they simply have a higher risk of having higher sugars during the pregnancy and need some assistance with either diet or with medication. And then after the pregnancy, they go back to normal, and there's no risk really to the fetus, to the newborn at all. There is risk if they do not get their sugars under control. There's a higher risk of the baby being larger than it would normally be, and having some other problems that may cause the baby to have to be in the intensive care unit for a short while.
Thank you for the question.
Okay.
One of the other things that a lot of our people are considering these days is doing pre-implantation genetic diagnosis,
right,
which is one extra step on top of in vitro fertilization or IVF. And that has a special set of concerns that go along with that procedure. You want to tell us a little about that, please?
Yes, hold on. Hold on just 1 second. I'm getting a call from... Yes, hi, Dr. Huff.
Hi. So let me just give you some background while he's on the phone, that pre-implantation genetic diagnosis is a way of taking a look at a fertilized egg at when you fertilize the egg and bring all the genetic material together. Now we have this potential human being, and we can tease one cell out when it's at the something like 8-cell stage or something, and analyze that, do some genetic testing, and find out if this blastomere is going to grow up to be a child with or without that condition.
Right. That is new on the forefront of in pre-implantation genetics and infertility treatments, and we have several places in the East Coast here that do that type of testing. You can test all kinds of different things on the one cell, but you can't test for everything.
Right.
You
and
much
so,
have
for
to know
example,
what you're looking for.
I was speaking the other day with a woman who has von Hippel-Lindau disease.
Yes.
She had nine of these tested. Three were not affected.
Right.
And so they've implanted one to try to have a healthy baby.
Right.
So, but what sort of special concerns are around when you do in vitro fertilization, which means we did it in the lab. We did we put the sperm and the egg together in the lab. We did whatever testing we were going to do, and then we've implanted it into the womb. From this point forward, is it more or less a normal pregnancy, or are there special risk things we need to worry about?
There are special risks. In vitro, in general, carries a risk of more complications in the last third of the pregnancy, including babies being smaller, the placenta not functioning completely normally in the, at the end and maybe needing an earlier delivery, babies, sometimes having an increased risk of needing, with the earlier delivery, needing admission to the intensive care unit for a short period of time. So there are testing units, antenatal testing units, where we test the baby's health in the last month or two of the pregnancy, which we would have those people who have in vitro go to on a weekly basis to make sure that the baby is growing well, that the baby's getting enough oxygen, and everything is going well in the last third of the pregnancy, and that, that is very important.
So it just needs to be monitored a little bit more closely.
Absolutely.
Right.
Now, I have an emergency delivery in the operating room right now.
Okay, well, I hope everything goes great. So thank you so much.
She's got twins, and we're hoping everything goes well. She's her first pregnancy and delivering twins, and one of the arms is trying to come down by itself.
Okay. Well, thanks.
I'm going to have to run. Thank you so much.
All best wishes. Thank you so
you.
Much, Dr. Huck.
Bye-bye.
And thanks, everybody. If you have any other questions, I'll do my best to answer them if I can. And meanwhile, we'll just carry on here a second. One of the other things that I should tell you about Dr. Hox is that he is the leading high-risk obstetrician for multiple deliveries. He's done more than 660 multiple births, so not only twins, but triplets and more. And one of the things he was saying is anything over three is very high risk, and not just to the mother, but a risk of mental retardation and other disabilities in the child. So if at all possible, especially when you're doing in vitro fertilization, I know sometimes people say, oh, it seems so cruel, how can I choose? They're saying I should thin out the population. Number one, you can just not implant more than two, maybe three eggs at a time. Because they might all take, you know, but sometimes they put in four or more eggs thinking, well, only a couple of those are going to take. But then if five of them do take, one of the things they will usually suggest to you is to thin out the crowd. And the reason that they do that is because there's really not enough room in there for five babies to flourish. So it may seem cruel at the time, but having five babies share a womb for that period of time is also cruel, and it can definitely result in lifetime disabilities. So the best thing to do is just not implant that many. That's the best way to avoid that situation. But in any event, there are good folks like Dr. Hux who are prepared to help with these high-risk pregnancies and make sure that the mother and the child come through this experience in very good shape. He also does fetal surgery, so surgery on babies still in the womb, because as we said, the best incubator of all is the mother's womb. And so as long as we can keep the baby in there and keep that environment healthy, as he mentioned, make sure that the mother is healthy and that the womb environment is healthy, that the chemicals and the oxygen that are getting through to the baby are healthy ones and not unhealthy ones. So number one, don't smoke, and make sure that what you are feeding that baby, both in terms of oxygenation and in terms of the chemicals that you're exposed to and the food that you eat, all of that is creating a healthy environment for growing a healthy and a normal baby. So any other questions, we'll be glad to answer. I think we're just about at the end of this, and we're down to the last 6 minutes of the show. So I'm going to pretty much close it. But we noticed that because we have such high infant mortality, and we have literally the infant mortality rate of a third world country, and 68% of that is because of premature birth. So 70% of infant mortality is due to premature birth. And in fact, one half of them are due to very premature births. So whatever we can do to try to make sure that the mother stays healthy, therefore the environment for the baby is healthy, and that the baby stays in there and gets fully baked before arriving into the world, all of that is to the good. And number one, get your teeth fixed. Number two, go to the doctor. Make sure you get good prenatal care and that the doctor is keeping an eye on the baby so that if there is any complicating factor for you or for the child, that it's going to get picked up early and it's going to be handled properly. So next week, we're going to talk with a nurse who is talking also about the healthcare reform from a nurse's perspective. She said, if you want to know how to fix healthcare, ask the nurses, because the nurses know, and the nurses are the ones who are mostly on the scene and able to help you. So we want to make sure that not only that the people are happy with the healthcare reform, but that the doctors and the nurses and the hospitals are happy and healthy through the healthcare reform. So we know that we need to make some changes. We need to make our changes wisely. And we're going to hear from the nurse's perspective next week about how to make those changes carefully and make sure that everybody is going to be better and that we don't lose as many babies. One of the things, for example, that they do in Sweden that we don't do here is that in Sweden it's illegal to smoke in any public place, including the out-of-doors, because the out-of-doors is also a public place. So anybody who's still hooked on nicotine in Sweden has moved to chewing tobacco, which is terrible for the person who is doing it, but at least it's not harming the other people around them. I was at dinner the other night, and the man across from me was a smoker. And I hadn't even realized he was a smoker because I never see him smoke. He only smokes, you know, a little bit outside or something. But sitting across from him at the table, it was so noticeable. We forget how much is projected into the air by people who smoke. And so we really all need to worry about that. And eating healthy is also a very important risk factor. As Dr. Huck says, each one of us needs to take more responsibility for managing our own health, and I'll include myself on that list. I don't always do that best myself, but more exercise, nutritious food in reasonable quantities, and let's all be very healthy. Not just the pregnant women, but everybody in our society needs to be well. And we hope that if you have other questions, if you'd like to see some of the material that we've produced on pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, we'd be very glad for you to see that. We have a webinar that's available at vhl.org/videos. There are a number of great videos there, and there are two on pre-implantation genetic diagnosis that will help you understand what's involved in that procedure and how to inquire about it if you're interested. But that's one way to try to not pass on a known genetic risk factor to a baby. And the most important thing is to take good care of yourself so that you'll be there to raise that baby and make sure that that baby will be happy as well as healthy too. So I hope that everybody has a great week and will join us next week to talk about nurses. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient. Thanks so much. I'll talk to you next week.